I'm Nicholas Meyer. I am the co-screenwriter and the director.
I'm Denny Martin Flynn. I co-wrote the screenplay with Nicholas Meyer and knew he was going to direct it all along.
And welcome to Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
A title which you invented and to which there's a story behind, isn't that correct?
It was the original title of Star Trek II, and at the time I didn't have enough clout or something to keep it, so it became The Wrath of Khan. All works of art are ineluctably the product of the time in which they were created, and that includes movies. Movies set in different time periods of history nevertheless usually reveal the time in which they were actually filmed and written. Star Trek VI in particular seems to me to be representative of a certain time and place, namely the world after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was originally conceived by Leonard Nimoy and myself in conversations on Cape Cod the year after the Berlin Wall came down, and is in some sense a response to and a reflection of that period in human history when, as the philosopher Francis Fukuyama wrote, we may have come to the end of human history. We'll come back to this notion as we go. The music composed by Cliff Eidelman is very different from the rest of the Star Trek main title music, which always began by, I think, imitating the stirring marches that John Williams produced for the Star Wars movies. It became traditional that outer space operas begin with a rum-ti-tum march, but since this movie was about the mysterious and unknown world of the Klingons, whom Leonard always said were our stand-in for the Russians, I thought that the movie should begin musically with something brooding and mysterious rather than the usual. Cliff Eidelman, who knew Holst the Planets very well, and Stravinsky the Firebird, was perfectly equipped. The china in this scene, and also in the banquet scene that follows, was made by the same company that makes the china for the White House. I always thought they should have made a lot more of it.
Well, the close-up was awfully important because it said Excelsior and set us on a different starship than the original Enterprise.
Correct.
I don't think everybody was going to know right away that Sulu was actually promoted. I was always under the impression that Sulu was promoted at the request of his agent, by the way. Is that true?
No. Like the collapse of the Soviet Union, this is a movie that is about the collapse of the Klingon Empire, and that collapse is prompted by an intergalactic explosion, a Chernobyl in space, if you will. For those who don't remember, Chernobyl was the Soviet nuclear reactor that melted down.
One of your theories is open with a bang. I think you succeeded wildly here.
Yeah, at the University of Iowa in the playwright workshop, where I learned whatever it is I know. Somebody pointed out that Macbeth started with a clap of thunder.
Negative, sir.
And that this was a very good way of getting people's attention.
3, 2, 3, mark 7, 5.
As I've said elsewhere, this is a movie which substitutes the Klingons for the collapsing Soviet Empire. The explosion here was really a paraphrase of Chernobyl, the nuclear reactor meltdown in Russia, and we just made our own intergalactic version of Chernobyl.
I was listening to some commentary recently where the whole collapse of the communist system started with Chernobyl, because the commentator felt that the people thought, if they can lie to us about this, they can lie to us about anything. And in fact, I think in this scene we're going to see the Klingons are going to try to
gloss
over the magnitude of the disaster.
Speak it, the High Command. There has been an incident on Praxis. However, everything is...
I wonder if people seeing the film 20 years from now will remember the metaphor that was Euron Leonard's original concept. I guess you talked about this already, but when I heard it, it made everything make sense. I got to be honest, I didn't know a thing about Star Trek before Nick asked me to collaborate with him on this, and I would never have been able to do it if it didn't have some grounding in the real world.
Here's a scene which really benefits from the tricks of Citizen Kane, where if you don't have enough money for the set, you can just let things fall off into darkness or use some black duvetyne tape and just concentrate on what's in the middle of the screen, and then everything else just goes more or less black. I like the idea that art thrives on restrictions.
This whole scene was a major restriction. Should I mention what it replaced? Originally, the story had these people in retirement and coming out of retirement. When the project was announced, in fact, David Letterman began doing jokes on his TV show and said it would be called The Search for Geritol. And we felt that we should confront this, that everybody was older, and that was okay. And they were in retirement. Kirk got the assignment, wanted his old crew, and went to 6 different exotic places in the galaxy to find where these people were now. And of course, they were all very bored and very anxious to get back into space. It was a sequence that Nick called the Roundup, and is classic in a lot of classic films. Unfortunately, that meant 6 exotic and difficult sets to build. And although I think everybody liked the sequence very, very much, it held on and held on, but just succumbed to the budget eventually. And Nick created this to take its place. But not to worry, I stole it all and used it in a prose version. I wrote a Star Trek novel called The Fearful Summons shortly afterwards, and had them actually in retirement. And
as I recall, Uhura was working for some kind of radio call-in show.
Exactly. And Sulu was a taxi driver in some foul and fetid planet somewhere where the traffic was driving him crazy. We had a number of nice things, and I think it would have worked out very well, but it would have pushed the budget over $50 million. You ended up with, what, about 25 or 30 to shoot the film?
This was a very hard speech for Brock Peters to do. In fact, it was so repugnant to him with its racist overtones that he was really unable to get it out in one take, which is one of the reasons why we provided several angles of it. But I suppose it was part of the point that these sentiments should be enunciated by an African American, and he understood that. This is also a movie about prejudice, and as such, Gene Roddenberry had a lot of difficulty with the script because he believed very strongly that in the future where Star Trek takes place, there would be no prejudice. And I, taking a somewhat darker view, pressed ahead with the notion that there is no evidence for the diminution of prejudice.
Without attacking the Enterprise under your command.
I have personally vouched for you in this matter, Captain.
Star Trek VI basically managed to anticipate and predict the Soviet coup. In this version, Gorbachev, the Soviet premier, is called Gorkhan, which was the name given him by Denny Martin. We worried if it was too much on the nose, but interestingly, a lot of people at the time just took the story on its own face value.
I wouldn't.
This is in fact a church up the street from Paramount with black drapes hung around the outside. And it really does focus on the drama by using the fade off into blackness.
My father requested that I open negotiations.
What's interesting, going back to this notion of the explosion on Praxis and the Chernobyl analogy, is we are learning now, as we are recording this commentary, that China has been very, very reluctant to be forthright about the SARS epidemic. There is an instinct to suppress bad news, disaster, that's very hard for them to shake.
Control, this is SD-103, approach to space dock. Over.
Nick reinvented the costumes for Star Trek II and moved forward in a way that really, I think, helped the pictures enormously. Because the original television series, they basically wear these odd pajamas that were science fiction of the 60s, I guess. And it was Nick in Star Trek II who insisted on this look.
Well, Star Trek VI, like the Star Trek since Star Trek II, emphasized, as I chose to emphasize, the nautical culture and nomenclature. It existed to some extent in the television series, but Gene Roddenberry was very adamant that the Starfleet was not a military or a militaristic operation, and therefore he was very leery of uniforms, and therefore they had these, what Denny calls these pajama-like outfits. I thought it was at least as militaristic as, say, the Coast Guard, and therefore they ought to have uniforms. So Bob Fletcher, who was the original costumer on Star Trek II, whose work here is being taken over by Dodie Shepherd, created all the ranks, insignia, and uniforms that have become sort of part and parcel of the subsequent Starfleet worlds. It's interesting to me that when Pauline Kael reviewed Star Trek II and talked about Ricardo Montalban, who was then starring in a television series, Fantasy Island, that she gave the nod to his terrific performance and said there wasn't a trace of Fantasy Island in it. When I look at Kim Cattrall, who has since been associated in the popular imagination with her libidinous role in Sex and the City, another television series, and yet a similarly great actor to Montalban, there is not a trace of that coquetry or other character from Sex and the City or any other sort of earthbound attributes. Just take a look.
Sorry.
You could have laughed.
We are almost at the rendezvous, sir. I thought that you would like to know.
Right.
I think we created this character first And then Nick had the wonderful idea to turn her into Savick and have Kirstie Alley reprise the role.
No, we started with Savick. It was,
we started with the idea that
was going to be Savick.
In the hope that Kirstie Alley would sign on.
And she chose not to do that. But again, it was playing, as with Brock Peters, Admiral Cartwright, whom we had seen in a benign context in an earlier movie, that these should turn out to be part of the conspiracy was designed to make the reaction to it all the more shocked and pained. We didn't get to do that ultimately, although I do think that we come to care for Valeris enough to be very disillusioned when we find out.
There's a great production design to his cabin here,
yeah.
I think. It's not quite as modern as everybody else.
Leonard was very disappointed with his cabin in Star Trek II and let me know it at the time in no uncertain terms. So I was working overtime to make sure that he had a special place.
Complete with turning points, Lieutenant. You must have faith.
Faith?
That the universe will unfold as it should.
This scene is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Here is a Vulcan having a complete nervous breakdown and the other Vulcan not noticing. They're both so intent on opposite concentrations that her tremendous anxiety about a new and different future, here the theme of the movie is really enunciated, change, and Spock's serene confidence that the universe will unfold as it should is completely lost on her, while her anxiety about that future is completely lost on him. As he later says, I guess neither of us were paying very much attention that night. I think Kim does a good job of walking the fine line of a Vulcan in the throes of an emotional meltdown. It's almost a contradiction in terms.
Captain on the bridge.
What I bring to the Star Trek franchise, the series, to a large extent is a kind of blissful ignorance. And so in depicting the Klingon culture and in the scenes that follow, I was unbound by knowledge, tradition of any kind. I know that the Klingons are supposed to be non-human, in the same way that I know that Vulcans are supposed to be non-human, but I guess it's my own limited thinking that I can only visualize them as humans, I can only depict them as humans.
Chancellor, we've been ordered to escort you through Federation space to your meeting.
In particular, this Gorkon Gorbachev character, played by David Warner,
for the Enterprise with my officers.
The idea that we had was to make him look like Abraham Lincoln and to be Lincoln-esque. For traditional Klingon haters, this may have seemed yet another blasphemy in the movie, but we had our reasons.
Well, I hope you're happy.
Captain, there is a supply of Romulan ale aboard. It might make the evening pass more smoothly.
Officer thinking, Lieutenant.
Guess who's coming to dinner?
I think there's two huge laughs in the movie. I'm always delighted if you can get a laugh on almost anything. And I like to tell people that it's a good sign of our collaboration that I wrote one of them and Nick wrote the other. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was my line, and Only Nixon Could Go to China was Nick's, and they're by far two of the biggest laughs in Star Trek history, I think.
But probably, as the years go by, the Nixon in China line will probably perish a little bit as people forget what was really remarkable about his trip to China. And here's the introduction of David Warner as a Lincoln-esque Klingon, somewhere between Ahab and Lincoln, but really more Lincoln was the idea.
Another one of the great actors who signed on, David Warner, was a notoriously great Hamlet in post-war England for the old Vic or the Royal or something, and a really fine actor. We should say on the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner that it was really written for Uhura. I felt it was appropriate for her to say that, and I didn't think twice about it. She decided that it was racist in some way and refused to say it. And at some point, we hung onto the line, but Nick gave it to Chekhov. I never quite understood that, but that's how it fell out.
And here is Chris Plummer as General Chang, with an eye patch bolted to his skull. Gene Roddenberry was very distressed by showing anybody on the Enterprise as racists, such as this.
Now, you know only top-of-the-line models can even talk.
In fact, one of the problems with writing Star Trek, which probably goes through hundreds of television writers and etc., is that Roddenberry, and he said this to me in the one meeting I had with him, felt that in the future there would be no conflict, that everything would be resolved. It's very hard to write drama with no conflict whatsoever. And that was always the conundrum in all kinds of Star Trek writing assignments, I think.
Well, as I think I remarked elsewhere, my vision of the future ran in a different direction from his. If everything was going to be peachy keen, I was curious to know what the evidence for that progression was, since I couldn't find any. Hence, there are racists on the Enterprise with regard to Klingons, and this is an awkward dinner, and they are making cracks about that they all look alike or they all smell alike or whatever. That was the subject of the movie. Or at least a subject of the movie. And here I indulge my passion for blue food by having the entire meal be blue.
One of the advantages of being 1,000 light years from Federation headquarters.
To you, Chancellor Gorkon, one of the architects.
Was it Christopher Plummer who inspired the Hamlet, the Shakespeare quotations, or was it the Shakespeare that inspired the casting?
It was both. I had a Chandos recording of the William Walton music for Henry V, the Olivier movie, but it was a new recording, and Chris Plummer did all the Shakespeare from the play on it, and I was so thrilled and listened to this thing again and again that I wrote the part and its Shakespearean quotations simply with Plummer in mind.
He was really one of his generation's great actors, and I really admired him, so I had to meet him when he was shooting that day. I decided that's the day I'll visit the set, you know. And he was very friendly. I introduced myself and we talked. And I remember that playing in the theaters at the time was a Cyrano de Bergerac film with a French actor.
Depardieu.
And Plummer had been a great Cyrano on stage. I couldn't help but talk about it, and I didn't want to insult the French actor's performance, but I kind of beat around the bush a little bit. You never know, all famous people know each other, you know. But finally, Plummer kind of got what I was saying, leaned over, put his hand on my arm, and said, "I know what you mean. He played it like a paisan."
We need breathing room.
Earth, Hitler, 1938.
I beg your pardon.
When he says, Chang, that you have never heard Shakespeare until you have heard him in the original Klingon, he is paraphrasing the Germans who, during or just before World War II, claimed Shakespeare as originally one of their own and said that you have never heard Shakespeare until you have heard him in the original German.
If there is to be a brave new...
And here is the heart of the dilemma. Kirk cannot imagine what Gorkon is talking about, and he cannot imagine that Gorkon is telling him anything that is true.
Well, most kind.
One of the great parts of the metaphor for me was that during Gorbachev's attempt to create, I think it was called Glasnost in Russian, I felt that there was a right wing in both countries against the ceasing of hostilities because they made money from the defense industry, and that eventually a cabal of people from all sides would in fact almost meet and try to agree to keep hostilities going. That resulted in the assassination and everything that's upcoming, but Nick ably described both sides with the Chang character and the Warner character and etc. And I thought that was very, very real. The so-called military-industrial complex, which we still suffer from in this country, which Eisenhower warned us about way back then, was against the idea of ending the Cold War because there were great profits to be made from...
I also think that in addition to the financial incentives, there is a psychological imperative. People are terrified of change. What the status quo is in a world where we understand birth, death, taxes, particularly moving, big transitions. These are all big transitions, and big transitions are tough for people. They might even simply prefer the devil they know, a world in a constant state of armed readiness for mutual assured destruction, to a world where you don't know what it's going to be. I remember when my wife was pregnant, we talked all the time about the pregnancy, and I said, well, what will we talk about after we've had the baby? Because we couldn't imagine another topic. We would say we would be out of topics.
I think that's something that you embodied really well in Kirk's character in writing this. It's very difficult in Star Trek after 30 years to come up with new ideas, but particularly to come up with new characteristics to characters that you're handed on a silver platter. You have to be very careful not to contradict 30 years of history, and at the same time, you're looking for new things. And as you just said, Kirk is an old warrior who is conceivably worried about change and thrust into a situation in which his old enemy is now his ally, in effect. And by doing that, you enriched Kirk's character enormously in this sequence in the story.
This is the sequence in the movie of which I am most proud. I always wondered why, when I see NASA footage, the astronauts are floating around, but when I see any other space movie, they're always walking. So I worked backwards and inferred the existence of a centrifuge that gives spaceships gravity. Then I wondered why that centrifuge never got broke in any of the space battles and decided to break it. I believe that had this sequence come at the end of the movie, it would have been the most remembered sequence, since it comes sort of a third of the way in or wherever we are. It's overshadowed by subsequent events, but I think it's pretty cool.
I'd be interested to know if there had ever been a zero gravity sequence in Star Trek until this time, because I know when we first discussed that, I couldn't imagine a scene in Star Trek's history, TV or film, that gave up the idea of gravity on a ship. It must have made it more complicated to shoot.
Oh, it was devilish complicated to shoot, that's for sure. One of the things, however, that made it easier than it would have been if it had been 5 years earlier was the onset of CGI, computer-generated imagery, which allowed us to make bubbles of blood, which otherwise, I don't know how we would have done it. We certainly tried other ways. But this was brand new technology for a feature film when we used it. Star Trek VI was among the first to go boldly.
And then we had to invent the gravity boots in order to keep the assassin's feet in the ground. And that pays off much later. I distinctly remember writing that the blood was green and seeing it for the first time that it was violet. And getting, as small as that seems, a great lesson in screenwriting, which is that you have to envision whatever you envision in order to deliver a complete blueprint for a movie. But you also have to be very flexible and realize that it's going to be totally envisioned later by the director and his designers.
I was never, in retrospect, entirely happy with the color that I wound up with, but I remember we didn't use green because Bones used to refer to Spock as "you green-blooded inhuman monster," so I thought the Klingon blood couldn't also be green.
And when you're writing Star Trek and you make a decision like that, there's a lot riding on it because now, thanks to Star Trek VI, all Klingon blood will have to be violet.
They're coming about.
Part of what Star Trek VI is also a murder mystery. It's got elements of The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, but also Agatha Christie. It's also a POW movie. It's also a trial movie. It used to be a movie with a kitchen sink, but that was cut.
They fired it.
We surrender.
With our shields down.
We surrender.
We will not be able to respond.
Repeat. Enterprise surrender.
A lot of people come to Hollywood able to write prose awfully well or plays awfully well and don't understand that a screenplay is a blueprint for a film in which you have a very short amount of time. You not only have to have the right word, you have to have the right number of letters, as if it's a crossword puzzle. And one of the things that Nick counts on, that he taught me, was quite simply never worry about effects or budget or anything else as you first envision your film. Write whatever you can imagine, and Hollywood will make it work. In most other forms of writing, you're more restricted. But that's one area in screenplay writing where you're not restricted at all. And I'm sure that this zero gravity scene arrived as it did out of our imagination, and then it had to be worked out as to how it was going to be played.
I always use it as an illustration of the distinction between the writer and the director in the writing process. When I was writing that scene, the director in me was tapping me on the shoulder and saying, "How are you going to do this?" And the writer in me was saying, "Go away, I don't want to worry about that now, fiddle-dee-dee. I'll think about it tomorrow. I just know that this is what I want to see, and it's the movies, and movies can do anything, and we'll figure it out." I didn't even know about CGI when I wrote the scene, but you can imagine how relieved I was to learn about it afterwards.
Coming up is another one of those little decisions that a Star Trek writer gets nervous about making. As soon as he does this, we have established that Klingon's anatomy has their heart approximately where humanoids are. And now Star Trek is stuck with that for the rest of its journey.
Sweet Jesus. Can you? Jim, I don't even know his anatomy.
I look now at the color of Klingon blood and wonder if I shouldn't have been bolder and made it even more outré than Pepto-Bismol.
He's gone into some kind of damn...
What I love here is Ron Roos's cutting. You film this stuff, you cover it every which way, and then a brilliant editor comes along and finds the moments. Watch the faces, watch the looks as this whole thing begins to go south.
Well, I can tell you how I came to write this. And first I'll say that I never had seen anything of Star Trek until that time. It just wasn't part of my world. So when I got the assignment, I had to go into a Paramount screening room and sit through 5 Star Trek films in a row. That wasn't easy, by the way. In any case, I was Nick's assistant for a number of years, and he made several films, and we had a great relationship. I also moonlighted as a writer. I'd published a couple of books and had, I think, 1 screenplay optioned or something. And as I said, Nick taught me a lot about the screenplay form and writing and stuff. When Leonard was approached to create Star Trek VI, there was already a very short amount of time left before the 25th anniversary, which is when they hoped to release it. And Nick was making a picture in Europe and invited me to collaborate with him. I was still in L.A., but email was very new then. We signed up for CompuServe, and I would write all day and then email it to Nick, who, because of the time change, would wake up, get the script, write all day, and then send it back, and I'd wake up, and there it would be. Unfortunately, just before that sequence, Paramount decided to sign 2 other writers to the project. Maybe you want to explain how the story developed between you and Leonard.
Leonard Nimoy came to see me on Cape Cod in the summer, I guess, of 1991, or maybe it was 1990. I get confused. With Paramount's blessing to propose a 6th and final Star Trek movie with the original cast. And he had a sort of a preliminary idea for what the subject of the movie would be about, using the Klingons as stand-ins for the Russians and trying to envision a new world that more or less paralleled the world in which we were living in post-1989 with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the downfall of the Soviet Union. And we tossed these ideas back and forth together on a walk up and down the beach. He went back to Los Angeles, I returned to London, and waited for marching orders. The next thing we heard was that 2 other writers had been hired to write this story. So I tried to be philosophical about it, and then some more weeks went by, and then I heard that could I consult with them and give them some... notes, and one of them flew to London, and I sat down with him and gave him a whole bunch of notes about how it was supposed to work. Then I waited for them to write the script, and then the next thing I heard was that Paramount wanted to start over, and at that point I invited Denny to collaborate, and I don't know what became of the other script. We just went off our own bat, and this was the result.
Unfortunately, in the development process that's so typical of Hollywood, a lot of time went by because of all that. And they still had their deadline of opening at a certain time in the future. And I recall that we had a very short amount of time to turn in a script that would get a green light, at least, the first draft. And something did happen that will probably never happen in either of our careers. We raced through it, and we put it all together, going back and forth between us. Nick was still in Europe. When Nick was satisfied, he said, okay, go ahead. And it was a Friday, and I walked the script over to Paramount. And on Monday, I got a phone call from the executive on the project saying, we're going to shoot this. You got a green light, which was flattering. Although, again, the first draft is always pretty far from a last draft. But at least we knew we were plunging ahead.
I had the same thing happen on Star Trek IV. On Star Trek IV, there was another screenplay, and that screenplay was discarded. at which point I was asked to come in and with Harve Bennett co-wrote the screenplay and again wrote it very fast. I think there's something to be said for making movies faster rather than slower. I think that the years that are now consumed in obtaining a green light and the funding for a movie and the amount of rewriting that scripts undergo overcooks them to the point where a lot of times spontaneousness and a sort of short order cooking is lost. Something happens that robs them of a certain spontaneity. And when we are writing at breakneck speed and turning things around really fast, there is a kind of energy and enthusiasm. I hate to repeat the word spontaneity, but it's there, that I think is sometimes lost when you have too much time. Going back to something that I said earlier about art thriving on restrictions, it's not just money that can be restricted to good effect. It's also sometimes time, and the fact that we didn't have as much time to second guess ourselves may have worked to the film's advantage.
We are experiencing technical malfunction. All backup systems inoperative.
Excellent. I mean, too bad.
Mr. President, I've been named Chancellor by the High Council in my father's place.
Madam Chancellor, you have my sincerest condolences on your recent loss. I want to assure you that this shameful deed will not...
Mr. President, let us come to the point. You want this conference to go forward, and so did my father. I will attend in 1 week, on one condition. We will not extradite the prisoners, and you will make no attempt to rescue them in a military operation. We would consider any such attempt an act of war.
We hope you'll be our guest here on Earth.
After recent events, you will understand if I say I prefer a neutral site. And in the interests of security, let us keep the location secret for now.
As you wish, Madam Chancellor.
The Hiblatari start in Nish.
They have Vachi
Kocha is dark to a winter demoge. Ka-la-la, pepper.
Gott mag dig att välja också. Nu vet att man nog tjockte mig.
Kan vi skäcka klav? Då vill vi in kapus.
Ett nackbett, mamma.
Your father was killed for what he wanted.
The peace process will go forward.
It is as I said, Mr. Spock. Inventory registers every torpedo.
Yet the data banks insist we fired. One computer is lying.
A computer doesn't lie.
Precisely, Mr. Scott. Therefore, we must inspect each torpedo visually.
That could take hours.
Nevertheless.
And if they're all there?
Then someone forged an entry in the data banks.
Gorkon's daughter has been named Chancellor. It was on the news.
But that Klingon bitch killed her father.
Her own father?
It is an old story, sir.
Yeah, they don't place the same value on life as we do, Spock. You know that. Take my word. She did not shed one bloody tear.
Hardly conclusive, Mr. Scott, since Klingons have no tear ducts. Lieutenant, any response from Starfleet since our dispatch?
Yes, sir.
And?
Commander Uhura is experiencing... technical difficulty, sir.
Curious. Very well. For 24 hours, we'll agree this conversation did not take place.
And I'm fascinated by the fact that there really is a Klingon language. I believe a man named Mark Okrand invented it. It did not have a verb for to be. So he was wildly frustrated when I told him I wanted... the Klingon General Chang to quote Hamlet, to be or not to be. It's the one thing you couldn't possibly say in Klingon, so he had to find a way around it. Here's the show trial.
Again, the great mythologies of classic films. I can remember the day when Nick said, a trial. And it just came together.
Also, notice the Klingon logo, the black, red, and white, which was certainly loosely inspired by the Nazi swastika, another element of the deviant Klingon culture that we're trying to evoke.
Over the years, there's probably been a greater change in the whole idea of the Klingons than there has been in the United Federation of Planets, because they've always stood for the enemy of some sort, and over the 30 years between 1960 and 40 years today, there's been quite a change in America's enemies.
Even as we've changed our view of the Russians.
Exactly.
The movie not only makes reference to history, which is to say recent planetary history of Earth, but also makes a lot of references to other movies and other movie moments, which was, I think, pretty unselfconscious. I'm not even sure how much I was consciously aware of it at the time.
You have a singular wit, Doctor.
For 27 years, I've been ship surgeon aboard the USS Enterprise. In 3 months, I stand down.
You know, I believe that you consumed rather generous amount of Romulan ale in the officer's mess on the night in question. Am I right, Doctor?
Objection!
Disdain.
We all did.
All of us. That doesn't mean that...
Was Chancellor Gorkon alive when you first examined him?
Barely.
Now be careful, Doctor. Have you ever, in your past, saved patients as barely alive as he?
I didn't have the medical knowledge I needed for Klingon anatomy.
I see.
You were there.
The eye patch nailed into the head is one of my absolute favorite design elements.
May I ask, do your hands shake?
Objection!
I was nervous.
No. You were incompetent.
You were incompetent!
That's one high-angle shot.
Well, it's a CGI shot.
It is. The camera's not up there hanging from the roof of the studio. That's interesting.
I was desperate to save him. He was the last best hope in the universe.
Star Trek VI was made on an exceedingly tight budget, and it was a point of pride and a point of necessity to figure out ways to skin the cat, to reuse, to shoot very carefully, to give the maximum impact that we could produce with the very limited means at our disposal. There's only a couple of moments, and this is not one of them, where I am conscious of those constraints.
That's not true.
Objection! Captain Kirk has not been identified as the assassin.
Sustained.
I offer him to the record.
Herman Zimmerman, who has designed a lot of the later Star Trek movies and the features, is so at home in this world. His real job is to reconcile the consistency of his vision with the different directors who come on various episodes and movies that he's involved with. I found him ingenious and congenial in melding these two prerequisites. I said to him, show trial. I said to him, bear pit, judgment at Nuremberg. I wanted headphones for simultaneous translation. I wanted Worf's grandfather to play his own defense attorney. And I think Herman Zimmerman, or Z as he was generally known, was absolutely brilliant at translating my bear pit idea into this show trial.
That Captain Kirk once held the rank of admiral, and that Admiral Kirk was broken for taking matters into his own hands in defiance of regulations of the law. Do you deny being demoted with these charges? Don't wait for the translation. Answer me now.
Don't wait for the translation. Answer me now. That was Ambassador Adlai Stevenson at the United Nations during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Another reference to real events.
I didn't know about the assassination. It must be hard for the people who have been regularly on Star Trek, especially long, continuous TV series and stuff, when outsiders come in with their own ideas. And they do have to coordinate the two. But I will say that if you look at Star Trek 1 and then Star Trek 2 in a row, you have to come to the conclusion that two outsiders, Harv Bennett and Nicholas Meyer, set the Star Trek films on the right track, which they were in great danger of going off of. So if an outsider comes to this, and I was an outsider too, you have a certain freedom because you don't know all the mythology and everything. But at the same time, you have a hell of a crew to help you. I remember getting about 3 pages of notes on an early draft sent from the production department, but I think they came from Roddenberry, with little things like Klingons only eat with their left hand or something like that, not that particular one. And then you have to coordinate that with your own vision.
I've always likened the Star Trek process to writing the music for the Catholic Mass. The words are the same. The text is the same. It's the music that's going to be different. Or pouring new wine into a traditional bottle of a traditional shape. The vintage will be yours, but it must fit into this bottle. Nobody pretends that the Requiem Mass of Verdi sounds like the Requiem Mass of Brahms or even of Mozart. They sound completely different while adhering to the same general thematic material. I don't mean musical thematic, I mean textually thematic material. That's Bob Easton, the foremost dialect coach in Hollywood, as the Klingon judge, tearing his voice apart, delivering the sentence.
You'll be taken from this place to the dilithium mines on the penal asteroid of Rurapinti. There to spend the rest of your natural lives.
Onterata Galaxy is the aliens' graveyard.
Better to kill them now and get it over with.
Lieutenant. Torpedo hit. Once again, please. Hold.
It is Enterprise. We fired.
That is not possible. All weapons visually accounted for, sir.
An ancestor of mine maintained that if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Now, for those in the know, the man who said that was Sherlock Holmes, which means that Holmes was Spock's Earth ancestor. For people who didn't know what it meant, it was simply an obscure piece of genuine logic. Every time I've been at a screening, people have always chortled at that line because Star Trek fans are just as likely to be Sherlock Holmes fans.
Beneath us.
I think that all these characters benefited enormously from the fact that they were older and more mature, and we were able to write a kind of broader characteristics into them. If you look back today on the original series, they were pretty shallow characters. It's taken a number of years for us to realize how many different aspects of all seven of the regulars anyway.
I heard a very interesting theory, one of the few theories that's ever actually caught my fancy, which is that in art, in literature, and in experience, everything is leading up to the present moment. In other words, when you read a book or see a film or view a painting, the sum total of all your experience of world history and art is contributing to your understanding of that painting. I said, all right, fine, well, good, unsurprising, I understand that. But the theorist then went on to say, and this was his point, that it also works backwards, that what you have seen now will inform things that you go back and reread and review, so that if you look, he said, for example, at early Star Trek television series, you will find them immeasurably enriched by the movies that came after them, because you bring your consciousness of those films to the original episodes. And the original episodes get better, more dense, more complicated, because you are bringing to them your experiences from subsequent films and world events, everything. It all works backwards.
And in fact, Star Trek now is one of the great literature canons, I think, of all time, up there with Conan Doyle's Holmes and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. It's why people are so deeply into the whole history and mythology of it. Now, here's another great example of screenwriting versus production. I don't know at what point this happened, but Nick suddenly said, the ice planet. We already had the idea of them in prison, and almost all of the scenes are all written out. In my mind, it was sort of a third world country, and it was going to be 1,000 degrees and difficult to move around in the heat and all this stuff, but we simply wrote the scenes as they were. And then at some point after that, Nick conceived the idea that it would be an ice planet, and I think it adds immeasurably to the visual nature of the film.
This was actually the result of a Paramount executive, David Kirkpatrick. We had it was a sand planet, and he said, I'm tired of hot desert planets. Can't it be something else? And the only thing else I could think of was an ice planet. That's a very rare breed of dog, incidentally. I've only seen a couple of them.
Work well, and you will be treated well. Work badly, and you will die.
This little box was stolen from the box that Colonel Saito stands on in the bridge on the River Kwai. I happen, among my other miscellaneous pursuits, to have authored 3 Sherlock Holmes pastiches, one called The 7% Solution, in which Holmes meets Sigmund Freud, another called The West End Horror, in which he intermingles with luminaries from the theatrical world of London, 1895, Gilbert and Sullivan, Oscar Wilde, Bernard Shaw, Ellen Terry, and The Canary Trainer, published in 1993, where he matches him wits with the Phantom of the Opera.
These caves are actually in the park here, aren't they?
Bronson Canyon. We went on 2 locations for this. Somebody once said to me, oh, you directed Star Trek VI, were you on location? And I said, yes, we were 3 weeks on Venus. But in fact, the two locations were Bronson Canyon, which is just north of the Paramount Studios in the beginnings of the Hollywood Hills, and the state of Alaska, where we shot some of The Ice Planet. Stephen Charles Jaffe, the second unit director and co-producer of the movie, went up and did that for me.
Thanks.
This will help keep you warm.
This was actually the first sequence to be shot, I believe.
Yeah. No, the first sequence to be shot was the Klingon listening post, the two guys listening to Enterprise posing as a Klingon vessel.
Set up all along.
Somebody up there wants you out of the way.
Contacts?
No, that's really her eyes. That's Mrs. David Bowie. That's Iman.
Any progress?
None. We have a crew of 300 turning their own quarters inside out.
This was a controversial scene. I think I mentioned this last time because I showed food. And it was a Star Trek lore that all the food on board Starfleet vessels was replicated in some way. My defense, besides a yearning to see a real galley on a ship, was that the food had to be replicated from someplace, so one chicken could be turned into 1,000 chickens. But you had to start off with one.
We may never have seen food before this in Star Trek. Certainly not a kitchen.
I'm having the refuse searched. If my surmise is correct, those boots will cling to the killer's necks like a pair of Tiberian...
One of the interesting things about the whole Star Trek canon is that other literary sagas like Sherlock Holmes and Lord of the Rings are created by a single person. Star Wars is, in fact, almost created by a single person because of the incredible hold over it all that Lucas has. But Star Trek has developed through any number of different pens and ideas over the years. It's resulted in a broader mythology than other sagas have. That makes it fun, too, I think, for the Trekkies and fans. So many more different issues and ideas.
Could take weeks, sir.
That's not even counting over 200 novels, actually.
Please inform Starfleet Command our warp drive is inoperative.
A lie?
There's a whole bunch of series, including the original cast, which is the one I did, and, of course, Next Generation and everything. Pocket Books has the rights to that. They're a division of Simon & Schuster, which I think is a division of Paramount and a division of Viacom, etc. But you go through something of the same principle. You turn in your first draft, and attorneys look it over to make sure that you haven't screwed around with the famous mythology at all. And they send you all sorts of notes, which are quite non-creative, but interesting. And then you move on from there.
You got him, Jim! You got him where you want him!
And for the record, the stunt in the fire was performed by Bill himself. He didn't want anybody else trying it.
They actually asked me to write the novel version of this film, and I turned it down at the time, not wanting to revisit it right away. And then a few months later got an idea for a sequel, in effect, and asked them if they would rather have that. And they said yes, so I ended up writing a novel, The Fearful Summons, and someone else who had a lot of Star Trek experience novelized this film for us. That's the setup for a little anatomy joke.
They'll respect you now.
That's a comfort. I was lucky that thing had knees.
That was not his knee. Not everybody keeps their genitals in the same place, Captain.
Anything you want to tell me?
In an ideal world, you would not have needed that second line. All she would have had to say was, that is not his knee. But I guess we felt we had to spell it out.
When whoever it is,
I remember thinking, I wonder if I can use the word genitals in a Paramount picture.
Do you want to get out of here?
There's got to be a way.
The cigar was a great directorial touch, I think.
Iman and I shared many a cheroot. That was back in those good old days when the director could smoke while he was directing. Now it's politically incorrect and injurious to your actors and crew.
Before retirement. What a way to finish.
We're not finished.
Speak for yourself. One day, one night, Kobayashi Maru.
Bones. Are you afraid of the future?
I believe that was a general idea that I was trying to convey.
I don't mean this future.
George Stevens once said that the CinemaScope screen was ideal for photographing a man lying down.
Of what might happen. I was terrified.
Here we come to the personal heart of this film. Or at least what was intended to be the personal heart of it. I don't know if it's regarded that way. But Kirk's inability to imagine a world in which he had no identity because he had no enemy.
A theme that wouldn't have been possible in the original series because there wasn't enough history yet.
And also because the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union when the series was created.
I'm beginning to understand why.
Well, if you've got any...
Star Trek always has seemed to me, in my limited knowledge of it, to reflect the world and time in which it was made. So if issues of integration are in the forefront of the public consciousness, you have that episode, I think, with Frank Gorshon, a man who's half black and half white. All art is, in fact, ineluctably the product of the time in which it was created. For this reason, for example, the music of Mozart doesn't just sound like Mozart, it sounds like late 18th century Middle European music. Or the paintings of Renoir are not only look like Renoir, but also they look like late 19th century French painting. Gershwin sounds American. He sounds like Gershwin, but he also sounds like Art Deco, the music of the 20s. If you look at three movies that are set in the same year, let's say 1776 for the sake of argument, and one movie was made in 1955, and one movie was made in 1975, and one movie was made in 1995, I venture to say it wouldn't take you 5 minutes of watching each of these movies to come within 5 years of when they were shot, despite the fact that they all allegedly are giving you a glimpse of the same year, 1776. But whether it's the eyelashes, the makeup, the choice of soundtrack, or the locutions of the dialogue, or the sophistication of the photography, or the sexual explicitness, you'll figure out within 5 years when this stuff was made. And Star Trek is no exception, and it reflects earthly concerns and contemporary preoccupations transplanted or objectified into an outer worldly context. This movie was clearly all about the wall coming down because it was made in the wake of the collapse of the Berlin Wall and of the Soviet Union, which followed, and all the concerns that raised.
We should point out that the cameo by Christian Slater is due to the fact that the casting director was his mother, Mary Jo Slater.
And Christian was a big Star Trek fan. As I said, many actors just want to add this to their resumes that they did one of the Star Trek movies. Whoopi Goldberg's involvement with one of the television series was based on the same thing, that she just loved the show and wanted to be a part of it. The This is all my favorite stuff, the stuff that shows you the parts of the Enterprise that are otherwise never seen and gets you off that damn bridge, which is the set I least like to work on because of the 360-degree coverage that's mandated by its design.
Including the blankets, which were eventually available to the public.
Yeah, that was my big contribution to souvenirdom, was to say I want Star Trek blankets. I was completely enamored of the blankets that were on the ship and what I wanted as my souvenir when the film was over was to have one of those blankets. I thought I'd sleep more securely knowing that I was being warmed by the same blankets that warmed the crew of the Enterprise.
I visited this set, and I remember walking up the hill next to a group of extras and looking over and seeing them all bundled up and thinking, why did the designer think that all aliens are warm-blooded? I guess writers think of those little things, but then you have to forget them.
Why do all aliens have two eyes, a nose, and a mouth? Why don't they look like jellyfish?
That's even truer.
What is the problem?
Perhaps you know Russian epic of Cinderella. If shoe fits, wear it.
Mr. Chekhov.
Must have been difficult to find an actor with feet that bad, huh?
Watch me.
What kind of creature is this? Last night you two were...
Don't remind me.
Get in.
Run!
One of the problems that Star Trek has always had is getting outdoors, because the budgets were never really equipped for much of that. And again, this was a question of allocating your limited resources in the most useful way. Going to Alaska for what may have been 2 days of shooting was nonetheless an extraordinarily successful use of what we had, because you just sort of can't do this on stage 23. This is actually the second unit crew in Alaska. The close-ups will be still William Shatner and DeForest Kelly back in the studio, but so well done, I think, that it's really not possible to distinguish. And Stephen Jaffe, who is an extraordinary photographer, photographed these very haunting images.
I hope 200 years from now we come up with a better way of keeping ourselves warm in cold weather than animal fur.
From the beaming shield. Mr. Scott.
You can also trace the whole history of Star Trek by looking at the banks of graphics behind the crew from the very first series. There's a guy on the TV series whose whole job is to keep those graphics going, designing them. They're all moving around now.
Leave me. I'm finished.
No! And what is sort of lovely about this, of course, is that this was the soundstage. But when you put it together, that's the movies, you can't tell.
I believe Viridian Patch was an invention of ours. I don't think that's in the Star Trek mythology.
They'll be able to locate us 2 sectors away, if they're even looking for us.
You also get to invent little things like that when you're stuck on a plot point.
And here was the first day of shooting on the movie.
Where's KK? Duj vets onuk, Rin.
We must respond personally. A universal translator would be recognized.
I'm not sure that hardbound books existed in Star Trek until Nick Meyer joined Star Trek. He's a great fan of literature. Has the Moby Dick references in the earlier film and this scene when they're looking for the translations.
Green.
What is your destination? Over.
Man.
Oh, me, so ho.
I always think Nichelle is at her best doing the comedic material. She has a good sense of timing.
Would you mind explaining that little trick you do?
I'm a Carmeloid.
Heard about you. Shapeshifters. I thought you were mythic.
Give a girl a chance, Captain.
I think that the CGI stuff that you see here, which is very early for feature films, I think had already been used in commercials before the features caught up with it.
But it was very new. Morphing had just come in.
She said, I thought I would assume a pleasing shape, which is a biblical reference. The devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape.
Cameloid was another invention that we were able to come up with to solve plot points.
Where
let you get this convenient clothes. Don't tell me that flare is standard prison issue. It's to let them know where we are. Ask her what she's getting in return.
A full pardon. Which doesn't cover this.
An accident wasn't good enough. Come on, Sloan.
Good enough for one. Two would have looked suspicious. Killed one.
Something escaped. Now that's convincing for both.
Since she always had her voice, the voice of Iman, in all her other incarnations, by rights, we should have kept her voice in this face-off between Kirk and himself. Would have been funnier if it had been her voice coming out.
They'll be along. Can't believe I kissed you.
And again, this was my ignorance of Star Trek. I gathered that there were episodes, or an episode in the television version, where Kirk fought himself in one of the stories as a double, but I didn't know this. Of course, if it was her voice, we'd instantly know which one wasn't him. So maybe we were right the first time. The clinches, the dialogue and the clinches.
Offhand remarks during the sword fights, classic mythology again of great films, refer to the great duels of Basil Rathbone.
Kill him, he's the one. Not me, you idiot. Him!
No witnesses.
Killed while trying to escape.
Damn clever, if you ask me.
It's a classic.
That's what he wanted.
Who? Who wanted us killed?
Since you're all going to die anyway, why not tell you?
His name is...
Well, it is true that this film, as is self-evident, is the last Star Trek movie with the original cast, and I have been asked many times if this represented a specific challenge or difficulty. And I would have to say that the actors approached it in a spirit of thorough professionalism. It wasn't until we got to the very last scene of the movie, which I think deliberately was the very last scene that was shot, that emotions ran high for the actors, who realized that they were now saying farewell to the roles in which they had immersed themselves for a considerable portion of their professional lives. When we get to that scene on the Enterprise bridge, it's a scene that I think is not as good as it should have been, partially because I think everybody was suddenly experiencing a lot of ambivalence about doing it, saying it, getting on with it, and suddenly finding a lot of questions about their dialogue. I don't like this, I shouldn't be saying that, shouldn't there also be something about, and during the rest of the making of the movie, it was, I think, fair to say, business as usual. And if these people were walking around with a consciousness that this was the last time they were going to be doing such stuff, I was unaware of it. And I think to some degree they were unaware of it. They were, A, busy doing their jobs as best they can, which is what actors do. And secondly, they were busy enough, or too busy doing this, to allow themselves to think about, or in some cases realize, or ultimately to even believe that this was well and truly the last time they would be doing this.
I remember at some very early stage of the outline or treatment, very early stage, I really wanted in the final scene for Kirk and company to turn the keys of the Starship Enterprise over to Patrick Stewart and the others. I thought we could make a nice link of some sort, only to discover that the second series took place 70, 75 years later, and there was no way I could work that out, so I dropped it right away.
Here's a scene that Leonard got me to write. I think in the original draft of the script, this scene did not per se exist, and it was a scene that was provoked and goaded by Leonard's correct dramatic instincts, both for himself as an actor and for his sense of what the story implies. He said, "Give me a scene which goes, 'Shoot if you must, this old gray head.'" And this is what I came up with.
I just assumed you didn't.
And he came up with that, which is the only time in all the Star Trek movies when, in his right mind, Spock loses it. And this scene I found inspired by Wagner's Die Walküre, where Brunhilde has a big set to with her father, Wotan, and when he says, "You disobeyed me," in effect, and she says, "I may have disobeyed what you said, but I certainly didn't disobey what you wanted. Did I misunderstand you?" Listen to her.
"All of you.
And what do you think you've been doing?"
"Saving Starfleet. Klingons cannot be trusted. Sir, you said so yourself. They killed your son. Did you not wish Gorkon dead? Let them die, you said. Did I misinterpret you? And you were right. They conspired with us to assassinate their own chancellor. How trustworthy can they be?"
It's not easy to write for a character that has no emotions. And you're constantly falling back on the issue that Spock is half-human.
Leonard said that he always played Spock not as a man or a creature with no emotions, but just the opposite, that his M.O., was to play Spock as an extremely passionate man who was always resolutely and determinedly holding his emotions in check, suppressing them, and that's where the tension of the character that brings him to life originates, from his forceful suppression in the face of mere or simple or ostensible logic.
In a TV series, the original actors have an enormous effect on the characters. You read early pilots and you think, how did they ever come to this? Sometimes it takes a whole first season to settle in. In that respect, I think that Leonard Nimoy's contribution as an actor is enormous. And the fact that there's a great deal of focus on Spock over the years, it's due to the power of his original conception.
Cartwright.
I find this to be a very erotic scene.
It was meant to be. It was meant to be erotic. It was supposed to be sexy stuff.
Who else? General. Chang.
This scene, I don't know if it was at the time or later, I always thought that as she was naming the conspirators, it would be a more powerful scene if we saw quick cuts of them during the course of while she was talking about them.
Where is the peace conference?
we were recollecting what our writing process was, and the writing process, to the best of my recollection, was that Denny would lay out stuff, and then I would come in a sort of secondary position and embellish and send back my embellishments to him. We were both quite ruthless with one another's stuff. It was sort of check your ego at the door. And he would say, this sucks, doesn't work for me, I don't like it. And I would say, oh, and vice versa, in effect. And I think by continually challenging one another, we actually brought the whole thing up several notches, because we were always playing devil's advocate to the material. I exercised, as the director, a sort of editorial discretion. I had final cut on this script, but that was the process that I recall.
When you're collaborating with the director, there's not too much point in taking a real argument right to the wall, because you know he's going to do it. The same time, that frees you to just pour out whatever material you can think of and then know that your partner is going to be the final editor. What's interesting is that most teams will sit together and write. And they have that maybe from long experience, and TV table writers, for example, can sit around 6, 8, 12 people in a room all throwing out lines. But Nick and I are both solo writers. Having written both before and since on our own, we're used to sitting down on our own in an empty room with a blank monitor and going to it. So we pass things back and forth more than saying, well, how about if he says this or how about if he says that? And that fed very well into the fact that we were thousands of miles apart. I would write something, email it to him, and go to bed. When I got back in the morning, there was his version. So it worked out, I think, really, really well as a collaboration.
I also think that there's something to be said for being in separate rooms, and the email thing is really a new way of writing and a new way of collaborating. One could say this about collaboration. It's either going to be heaven or hell, but it may not be the heaven you imagine or the hell you imagine. And by this I mean, if you are sitting in a room working with somebody that you get along with too well, the collaboration may suffer from a lack of critical introspection. Your best collaborator may not be somebody that you like or that who likes you, but he may be somebody who appreciates you and brings out the best. Gilbert and Sullivan did not work in the same room. Gilbert wrote the words, mailed it to Sullivan, who wrote the music, who mailed it back to Gilbert, who conducted rehearsals, and Sullivan came in on opening night and conducted. Similarly, and more recently, Billy Wilder and Charlie Brackett, who did Sunset Boulevard and a lot of other Double Indemnity and so forth, they did not particularly get along. They worked and finally broke up because one of them said it was too much like a marriage, and the fights were apparently horrendous, and they were in the same room. By the same token, when you ask certain actors how they feel about certain directors, they are unable to make a distinction between the process and the result. So Keenan Wynn will tell you that his favorite, when asked about Stanley Kubrick and Dr. Strangelove, will say, oh my God, what a dreadful experience, you know, take after take after take, omitting to remember the fact that it's for that performance with that Coca-Cola machine that he's most sort of famous. Whereas if you say to Keenan Wynn, who was your favorite director, he'll tell you Jack Smite. And then I challenge you to remember the movie he made with Jack Smite. But he got along with him.
In fact, Gilbert and Sullivan disliked each other, broke up several times, and were completely disparate personalities.
Well, Gilbert said with Sullivan, the one thing you never had to do was explain a joke. And Sullivan said of Gilbert, he wasn't strictly speaking musical, but he had an impeccable sense of rhythm. And that they appreciated one another, and the liking was not was not necessary. And it wasn't that they were enemies, it was that they were just temperamentally completely dissimilar.
Let us redefine progress to mean that just because we can do a thing, it does not necessarily follow that we must do that thing.
Uhura?
Nothing, Captain. If she's here, she's rigged for silent running.
Coming up on transporter range in 57 seconds.
Transporter room, stand by to beam down.
53. Seconds.
I can see you, Kirk.
Chang.
I think it was creating this sequence that we actually realized we'd need a third ship and promoted Sulu to the Excelsior, which effectively took him off the Enterprise for the other scenes.
No peace in our time.
But he'd always wanted to be promoted anyway.
This, again, another reference to World War II, peace in our time. That was Neville Chamberlain's hope when coming back from the Munich conference with Hitler, that they would achieve peace in our time.
This is fun. Reverse engines.
On the stern. 1.5 impulse power.
Back off, back off.
America was also developing the famous stealth aircraft at the time that could fly without being discovered by radar, which had a great effect on the ideas of the cloaked bird of prey being able to shoot while it was cloaked, and etc.
There's only two rules in show business as far as I'm concerned. One is, if it works, leave it in. And the second rule is, variety is the spice of life. I don't know what the third rule is, unless neatness counts.
Then he speculated about my father's motives. There were those who said he was an idealist.
I've had the experience of reading a lot of screenplays, and verbosity is just the thing that can kill a screenplay more than anything. Add to that the fact that executives and producers have a very short attention span as it is, and would much rather be out having lunch than reading a screenplay, but they have to read screenplays, really leads you to try to become very concise. And both of us will comb a screenplay for a word that can be eliminated effectively. How much of this is fireworks and how much is special effects?
No, that's all on camera. All those explosions were on camera. And in fact, when William Shatner saw the wiring for it when he first came on the set that day, he thought it seemed a little skimpy. Said to me, is this going to really do the trick? And after it all went off, I turned to him and I said, was that good enough for you? And the special effects man on the show came up to me afterwards and said, what's your drink? And I said, what? He said, what's your drink? Because whatever it is, I'm sending you a case of it. He had been, I think, annoyed to have his expertise questioned by the star, and he liked that I stuck up for him at the end of the day. So I think I got a case of cognac out of it.
I guess that today filmmakers wouldn't bother to do any of it live.
Oh, yes, they would. Yes, they would, because I think the ability for the actors to interact with the effects is always compromised when you add them later.
That's true.
So it gives everybody a chance to be in the scene if it's actually happening.
Our rebels now are ended, Kirk.
And now he's quoting from The Tempest, which is indeed Shakespeare's last play.
And let's slip the dogs of war.
Julius Caesar.
Bones, where's my torpedo?
Bet you wish you'd stood in bed.
She's collapsing!
Key, please, Doctor. Time is short.
And again, here the film's plot and the theme come together. The idea that if we think we have reached the end of history, if we think we have run out of enemies, we may try desperate measures to stop the clock or even turn it back to what is more familiar. Better the devil we know than what we don't. The other thing that we haven't talked about thematically in this commentary is not just the macrocosmic view of this, the geopolitical view of the end of the Klingon or Soviet Empire and the geopolitical, the world or universal change that's going on, but the personal level of how we respond personally to radical change in the status quo. Births, marriages, deaths. The United States, since 9/11, 2001, we've all gone into a different place. The world has changed. Something big has happened, perhaps even more profound than the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. How do people in their personal psyches react to and deal with profound change? At the very beginning of this movie, she tried to tell him how terrified she was of what was coming. And because he did not have the same dread of it, and tells her that the universe will unfold as it should, he misses what she is capable of doing to try to forestall or alter the nature of the change that is coming. The change precipitated by the fall of the Klingons.
Arrest those men!
Arrest yourself!
We've got a full confession.
I spent a number of years dancing in Broadway musicals and never envisioned myself as a screenwriter, that's for sure. When I retired as a dancer, I wandered out to L.A. and ended up with a job at Paramount Pictures, more or less as a temp typist. I'm fond of saying I worked my way down to screenwriting in Hollywood. I got a job as Nick's assistant early on and spent a number of years assisting him, being his right-hand man. He was making Star Trek IV, I believe, and made a number of pictures in between. Simultaneously, I was moonlighting as my own writer, had a couple of books published and a screenplay optioned but never produced. But we became aware that we got along well, and I think that I really admired his writing and started to develop my own almost as a pattern from his, at least in the screenplay form. And then Leonard went to Nick and said, Star Trek VI. Nick was busy making a picture in Europe and said, okay, but I'm going to ask Denny to collaborate with me. I don't have time to do it myself.
Once again, we've saved civilization as we know it.
Yeah, and the good news is they're not going to prosecute.
Oh, they might as well have prosecuted me. I felt like Lieutenant Valaris.
Well, they don't arrest people for having feelings.
And it's a good thing, too. If they did,
if you look at Star Trek 1 and Star Trek 2 side by side, you will see that Paramount owes the entire franchise to two men, Harve Bennett and Nicholas Meyer, who saved the films of Star Trek, because there's no way after Star Trek I the same format would have successfully been followed. And Nick brought to it an outsider's view and a sensibility for feature film, whereas stuck in the TV episode world, it would never have gone very far. And Nick and Harve brought a feature film sensitivity to, which put it back on track, which would include the explosion at the beginning and the huge explosion at the end, two nice bookmarks, but which stand for a larger issue. Nick has a great feeling for pace. And I would say that Leonard does too. And 2, 4, and 6 are notoriously very successful films. So sometimes the outsider's view can be a big help.
Go to hell. If I were human.
Course heading, Captain.
Second star to the right. And straight on till morning.
And the idea, or the quotation, to put it more obliquely, is from Peter Pan.
Captain's log, stardate 9529.1. This is the final cruise of the Starship Enterprise under my command. This ship, and her history, will shortly become the care of another crew. To them and their posterity will we commit our future. They will continue the voyages we have begun and journey to all the undiscovered countries, boldly going where no man, where no one has gone before.
And that, of course, is the first unisex ending. Up till then, it was where no man has gone before. But again, reflecting contemporary values and trends, we now include everybody.
And now we have the famous signatures, which drove me a little crazy.
Oh, it's just milking everything for every last emotional heartbeat.
The original idea of this was for the crew to sign the log. And it actually comes from the finale of the musical 1776, in which we see the Declaration of Independence on a scrim, and behind them the actors signing. I walked into a editing room to see Ronnie one day, and one of his assistants turned to me and said, "Geez, that stuff at the end, it's going to cost us $85,000 of our editing budget. It's kind of stupid." I said, "Wait a minute, it's not so stupid. I think it's..." And I went to look, and it had been changed from the crew signing the log, Captain James Kirk, etc., to the actors signing the picture. And I had something of a heart attack, because I thought that was really...
Well, I was wondering why we did that.
Ralph,
I thought that
Fincher
was your idea.
Exactly. Now I'm to be blamed for this thing for the rest of history. Turned out that Leonard wanted that. And Ralph Winter, who was the producer, I said, "Ralph, what is this, Jane?" He said, "Leonard insists."
The wrap party,
sure,
was at the Flying Museum in Santa Monica Airport.
And the opening party was at Leonard's house, which was nice of him.
I don't remember anything specific about the wrap party, except I was given the Klingon, the steering wheel from the Bird of Prey. This enormous thing that was impossible to move was my gift from the crew. What I really wanted was one of the blankets from the crew bunks from the Enterprise. And I was told that I could have it, but that it was a stencil and it wouldn't stand up to any wear or dry cleaning. That was when I got my great idea that most souvenirs are either cheap or they are sort of not really relevant In other words, a Star Trek mouse pad. I don't know how that relates to Star Trek, but a Star Trek blanket, that sounded like a real quality item, something that wouldn't you sleep better knowing that you were sleeping under the same blankets that sheltered the crew of the Enterprise? I know I would, blah, blah. So I persuaded them to make these blankets, which they did, feeling that it was sort of too upmarket, but they would do it if I would agree to sign a certificate of authenticity for every blanket, which I did. For a small percentage of the millions and millions that were to be made, I believed. And I used to tell my wife, you know, whenever we have economic difficulties, all we have to do is go out and buy some of those blankets, and because we get 10% or whatever it was. And that was the first time she attempted to have me committed.
I remember getting a crew jacket and finding that inside it was embroidered the line
Fendo Pomsky,
which I had created an other non-Klingon alien language for that little sequence.
In the prison camp, in the gulag.
Iman said it with such ferocity that it became a thing among the crew. If anybody was mad at anybody, they would just shout, Fendo Pomsky.
And all the jackets had it inscribed.
And so they described it inside the jackets.
I've still got mine, yeah. People yes. thought it was my name at cloakrooms.
I find that writing Star Trek, and I've done it since, has both positive and negative input to the writer. On the one hand, you're given a whole history that already exists within which you have to function, and it can be very frustrating because you can't go outside the box very often or Paramount will slap you down. On the other hand, you're given an awful lot to start with, seven terrific characters and etc. So it has both pros and cons to a blank page. That makes a big difference to a writer.
For a person who knew nothing about Star Trek and professed genuinely, I think, for the longest time not to understand it, I unexpectedly to discover my involvement with these movies was among the most rewarding of my professional life so far. It was really interesting to create within the limitations and restrictions imposed. If my headline is that art thrives on restrictions, and as Denny points out, there are so many restrictions, I sort of get off on that, and I don't know why. I'm much better in any situation where I'm limited and have to figure things out within a framework than if somebody says, here's a blank page, put on anything you want. Then I tend to freeze. And I think that's also true of my directing as well.